Well, everyone here has heard about the devastation caused by Hurricane Harvey in Houston. And we've all heard the stories of how the storm surge came onto shore and it washed away cars and trucks and even some homes. And we've heard about 100-plus mile-an-hour winds that knocked down signs and billboards and buildings in some cases. And we've seen the pictures of the devastation and the damage and the destroyed buildings and the destroyed city and the displaced people. And estimates put this natural disaster at between $40 and $100 billion. It is the most expensive, most costly, the worst natural disaster the U.S. has ever seen. But it seems then, to add insult to injury, there is now another storm coming up the south end of Florida, which is hitting the Florida Keys even as we speak, Hurricane Irma, which has been measured to be the largest storm ever to come out of the Atlantic Ocean. And anytime we see a natural disaster like that, as I said, we start to see the pictures. We see in the news. We see the pictures on Facebook, on social media. We see the devastation. We see the flooding. We see the fire. We see the hurt and the pain. But we also see some hope. Because those pictures not only show the destruction, but they show Americans coming together. Locking arm in arm and hand in prayer and in support. And we see thousands and thousands of volunteers pouring into that area. And millions of dollars of help pouring into that area. And convoys and caravans of trucks just pouring into that area. And through all of that, what we do is get a sense that no matter how bad that storm may be, those people, we as Americans will persevere, we'll get through it. And we know Americans will get through that storm because Americans have gotten through other storms. In the early 90s, America got through Hurricane Andrew. In 2001, America got through the September 11 attacks where terrorists hijacked four planes and ran them into the Twin Towers in New York City, the Pentagon, and here in Pennsylvania, a field. America has gotten through Hurricane Katrina. New Jersey got through Hurricane Sandy. Minot, North Dakota got through flooding. Missouri got through the largest tornado ever measured at 2 miles across. And Houston will get through this. And Florida will get through this. Because we've seen storms before and we've got through storms before. But I want to talk about a different kind of storm in this series we're in. It's a storm that is currently raging. Only instead of a hurricane of water and wind and waves, this is a storm of persecution. And its winds are bearing down on the church unlike anything we have ever seen in our life. In fact, Christian persecution is at such an all-time high right now that a ministry called Open Doors USA wrote this, 2014, just a couple of years ago, will go down in history as having the highest level of global persecution of Christians in the modern era. And when we think about organizations like ISIS and their treatment of believers in Syria, in Africa, in the Middle East, and we think about places in the world like North Korea and China and Iran, places where the Christian faith has been legislated to be a capital offense punishable by death in some cases. When we consider those realities, it's not hard to believe Christian persecution is at an all-time high. But the truth is, in those areas of the world, that's always been true. North Korea has always been hostile to Christians. China, Iran, ISIS and their followers, they've been around a long time and they've always been cruel to believers. But that storm has taken an unexpected turn. And for the very first time, we're seeing the winds of that storm come upon our shores here in the U.S. And we're seeing laws and we're seeing policies passed and enacted simply to target believers. Not too long ago, the Christian Post interviewed Franklin Graham, who is the president of Samaritan's Purse, by the way. And he said this, "We've already seen many laws that have been passed that restrict our freedom as Christians. I believe it's going to get worse," he says. "We do have a problem in this country, and we're losing our religious freedom, and we're losing it a little bit day by day." Now, please understand, this is not about politics. This isn't about whether or not you're a Republican or an independent or a Democrat or a conservative or a moderate or a liberal. That has nothing to do with this. It isn't about who you voted for. It isn't about who you supported in the polls. This is higher than politics. This is spiritual war, and there is a storm, and every believer is in its path. But you should know that just like America has gotten through storms, and so we are confident we'll get through these, the church has gotten through storms. And we know that we'll get through this one as well. In John 16, Jesus said, "I've said these things to you that in me you may have peace. In the world you'll have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world." And that's what this series, Unshakable, is all about. It's about getting through the storm of persecution that the world seems to be sending our way. And we will. The winds may blow. The waves may crash, but the church will endure. Jesus said in Matthew 16, "On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." And one of the reasons we know the church isn't going anywhere is because it's built on the unshakable foundation of the permanence and the righteousness of God. I've always liked that old hymn that says, "Our faith is built on nothing less than Jesus and his righteousness." We know the church isn't going anywhere. Another reason we know the church is going to make it through this one is because the church has seen storms before. When the church started, it faced a storm, it faced a hurricane, it faced tribulation. And that's what Peter's letters are all about. It's about encouraging believers who find themselves in this very situation. And it's interesting because when you look back through the history of the church, what we find is that often it does the best during times of persecution. It does the best during times of hardship. That it doesn't flourish necessarily in times of prosperity, but rather in times of persecution. And the same is still true today. If you look at areas of the world like China, Iran, and North Korea, and places that are very hostile to the Christian faith, what you see is not a retreat, but you see victory. You see the church is exploding. And the same thing happened in Peter's time, because the early church faced persecution from Rome, from Jews, from the rest of the pagan world. And yet it says in the book of Acts, the Lord added to their number daily. In the face of everything that was going on, God built his church. It says later on in chapter 4, many of those who heard the word believed, and the number came to about 5,000. And just like those believers at that church in that time weathered that storm, we're going to get through this one. And to help us do that, we want to look at the letters, the part of the Bible that helps us do that very thing. Because that's what Peter's letters are all about, encouraging the church during a storm. And so we've opened up to 1 Peter chapter 1. Look with me today to just the first two verses. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who are elect exiles of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, according to the foreknowledge of God the Father in the sanctification of the Spirit, for obedience to Jesus Christ and for sprinkling with his blood, may grace and peace be multiplied to you. When I was a police officer, we wrote a lot of reports. Sometimes three, sometimes five a shift. And they all started the same way. I, officer so-and-so, and then came the narrative. And that's exactly how our supervisors told us to write it. Because they said, I don't want to have to wait to get to the end of the report to figure out who wrote the thing. When we know who writes the letter, it makes a difference. It gives us a perspective that otherwise we would lack. And so right here, Peter introduces himself. We know who wrote this letter. It says, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ. The first few words of this letter introduced the author. And I think that's deliberate. Not only was it traditional, but in this particular case, it gives us a sense of hope even from the beginning. Because there is probably not a single person more qualified to write a letter like this than Peter himself. And I say that because Peter had been through the storm. Peter suffered persecution. Peter understood what it was like to have the pressures of the world bear upon him. Peter had that experience. And it's always more comforting when the person giving you the advice is the one who's been through it before. I remember when we first moved out here, we were looking for a pediatrician for our kids. And the lady we ended up with, we really like her, but that first conversation was a bit awkward. Because we were talking about benchmarks and we were talking about growth and milestones. And she was saying, well, the chart is here and the growth curve is here. And the books say this and the articles say that. And it just dawned on me at one point to ask her, do you have kids? And she looked at me and said, well, no, I don't. But the charts say, and the books say, and the journals say, and I couldn't help but laugh. She's a very nice lady. We've come to love her very much. But what she had was intellectual knowledge. And there's a big difference between that and experiential understanding. Well, Peter has experiential understanding. He's been through the fire. He's stood in the storm. He knows what it's like to be battered and bruised and to fail. You remember the time that Jesus was about to be arrested. They were still in the upper room. It was John chapter 13. And Peter and Jesus are having this sidebar conversation. And Peter and his pride got the best of him. And he said, I will lay down my life for you. And Jesus, I can just imagine him standing there kind of shaking his head. Because in the very next verse, he said, the rooster will not crow until you've denied me three times. And that night, that's exactly what happened. They would leave that upper room. They would travel to the Garden of Gethsemane where Jesus would pray. And Peter, along with the other apostles, they all fell asleep. And Jesus is arrested and he's hauled off to court. And Peter kind of tails behind. And it tells us in Matthew chapter 26, he was sitting outside the courtyard. And a servant girl came up to him and said, you were with Jesus. And it says just a couple of verses later, but he denied it before them all, saying, I don't know what you mean. And two more times that night, he will deny Jesus. He will deny his faith. He will fail. And then there was the time Peter was preaching in the book of Acts. But the problem was the Jews didn't like his message. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes, the legalists, they couldn't stand that he was preaching a message that freed people from the law that they had built their livelihood on. And so they put him in jail. And they only released him after he was warned not to ever preach that message again. And so Peter's been there. Peter has dealt with persecution. Peter has dealt with challenges to his faith. And it's only fitting that Peter writes this letter to encourage believers when we face the same thing. And so we have our writer. Second, we have our reader. Notice what else he says. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who are elect exiles of the dispersion. The New Living Translation puts it this way. I am writing to the chosen people of God. Peter isn't writing to the rest of the world. This isn't evangelism. This is not a letter where he hopes to take an unbeliever and turn them into a believer. This is a letter for the church. This is a letter for you and for me, and more specifically during hard times, because notice he says, the elect exiles, to those who are facing difficulty. You see, when the church first came around in those early days, those believers faced so much persecution, many of them just packed up their bags and left. They left Jerusalem, they left the area, they went into the region around it, they went into the nations and the area and the foreign lands around them, and they just left. It was a mass exodus of Christians. And it's worth noting that same type of thing is still happening even today. Because when you go to nations like Syria, for example, Christians are marched out of that nation. They're marched out of their homes. They're marched out of their towns, thousands at a time. In one particular town, more than 4,000 believers, two-thirds of that population, evicted from their homes in the same night. And so it's happening today, and it happened then. It happened in these letters, and that's exactly what Peter is dealing with here. Believers being forced to leave because of persecution. And so they become exiles. But there's another type of exile we deal with as well. It's not physical, it's social. It's familial. And you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's that pit of your stomach kind of discomfort that you feel when you're surrounded by worldly views. when you're in the middle of a world bent on attacking Christ and no one seems to care. It's that type of discomfort you get when you're surrounded by a world that is anti-Christ in almost every way. Jesus said in John 18, "My kingdom is not of this world." But as believers, we're part of his kingdom. And at the same time, we live in this world. And so there is a friction there. There is a discomfort there. And you should know that rub doesn't just come from people you know. It can come from members of your own family, people you're closest to. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 10, a person's enemies will be those of his own household. There will be people in your family that don't get your faith. And you've probably dealt with this yourself. People who just don't understand, why is it you're in church when you could have stayed in bed? Why is it you give your money here when you could do with it whatever you please? There are people, even in our own families, that won't get this. And I have to say, as a family, my wife and I, we deal with this. Anytime we travel home to visit family members, we deal with this. Because the truth is, many of my family, and even my wife's family, many of them are not saved. And so they can't understand why it is we don't want to watch their TV. And why it is their jokes just aren't funny to us. And why it is I'd rather be in a church among the people of God than some carnival or some festival somewhere. And so even in a childhood home, I can feel, and you can feel, and we can all feel like strangers in a foreign land. But here's where it gets even more complicated. Because as a believer, that's exactly where you want to be. Not necessarily with your family, but with the world. You want to be uncomfortable with the world. You want to have that sense of friction when it comes to worldly stuff and worldly influences. And it should raise the little hairs on the back of your neck when something of the world comes across your path. In the book of Romans, Paul tells us in chapter 12, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." Or remember what Jesus said in John 17, "I am no longer in the world, but they are in the world. My believers are in the world. My church is in the world." And he goes on to say, "But they are not of the world." You see, one of the things as believers we're called to do is to grow in Jesus, to grow in our knowledge of the Bible, to become closer and closer to Christ and more righteous and less like the world. And every time you take a step toward Jesus, you take a step away from the world. And so those feelings of uneasiness don't mean you're doing something wrong. It means you're doing something right. I like what one author said, "Scripture holds two ideas in tension. We are simultaneously exiles in this world and agents of change within it. Because we are exiles, we resist conformity to the patterns of this age." One of the things we've noticed about our kids, and we were just talking about it not too long ago, we were sitting on the couch noticing that Noah, who's like this old, whatever that is, he's 18 months. My wife talks about him in months, so I really don't know how old he is. But he's one in a bit, okay? And there's toys that we have in the living room that he used to be addicted to. And yet now that he's gotten just a couple of months older, he couldn't care less about. He's gone on to bigger and better things, and he's left that stuff behind. And as believers, the same thing happens in our lives. As we grow in our faith and we grow in Christ, we become less and less attracted and comfortable and at ease with the things of the world. And so Peter is writing to believers. To us, to the church, in the world, he says, to the elect exiles. And so we have our reader. Third, we have a reason. Notice what he goes on to say in verse 2. "According to the foreknowledge of God the Father, in the sanctification of the Spirit." We do a vegetable garden every year, and usually we have the same variants. There's green beans, cucumbers, zucchini, and tomatoes. Four things. I can grow four things. And that's about it. I like it that way. It's simple. I know what I'm doing. I don't get confused. But this year we decided, well, let's add something, and we tried potatoes. And so we took a section of the garden and we tilled it real deep and real fine, and we put our potatoes in. And if you've ever grown potatoes, you know you have no idea what you have until you go harvest. Because that plant could be 3 feet tall, but since all the potatoes are beneath the surface, you really don't know what's there. And so we were out there one day with the kids, and we were pulling these potatoes out of the ground. And I don't know if we did good or bad, but we got some potatoes. And we thought, well, hey, we got something from our effort. It wasn't a total waste of time. Let's celebrate, and we'll have baked potatoes for dinner. And so as we're pulling these potatoes out of the ground, we're taking some and we're setting them aside just for dinner, just for that purpose. And that's a very crude analogy of sanctification, because it means being set aside for a specific purpose. And more importantly, being set aside for a godly purpose. Right now, you are all sanctifying your time. I don't know if you knew you were doing that, but that's what you're doing. This is time you could have given to anything else. You could have given this time to the snooze button. You could have given this time to a place that one elder I know told me was the Church of St. Mattress. You could have given it to that. You could have given it to the restaurants. You could have given this time to anything, but you pulled it aside. And you sanctified it for a godly reason, to come into church, to be around the people of God. When you give of your money, your tithes, your offering, you're sanctifying that money. You're saying, this is how much I have, and I'm setting some aside for a godly reason. Well, Peter reminds us in his letter that as believers in the world, the reason we're exiles, the reason we have difficulty, the reason we feel dispersed, the reasons that we don't get along with the values of this age is because we're not part of it. We've been removed. We've been set aside. In 2 Thessalonians, the Apostle Paul says, God chose you as the first fruits to be saved through the sanctification by the Spirit. You see, God has a plan for your life, and at the moment you made Jesus Lord of your life, you were removed from the kingdom of the world, and you were placed into the kingdom of God. You were set apart. You were sanctified. And all of a sudden, your old life becomes less and less attractive. Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old has passed away. Behold, all things have become new. You should also know the world won't get that either. They're not going to understand why it is you've sanctified your time and your money. They're not going to understand why in a nation where the idea is nobody's my boss and I can do what I want, why would you take your life and that freedom and voluntarily submit to a God? Why would you give that to Jesus? Why would anyone of their right mind come into submission to someone else's will? They're not going to understand that. The Apostle Paul also says in 1 Corinthians 2, the natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God. It says they are foolishness to him because they are spiritually discerned. The world isn't going to understand. And if it's one thing we know about human behavior, it's that when the world and then people don't understand something, they attack it. And even though the world doesn't get it, your enemy does. He understands full well what's going on. And he doesn't like that you're leaving him and pulling your chair up next to his judge. And so he'll send the world, and he'll send the storm, and he'll go after the church because the church has been set aside. The church has been sanctified. So we have our writer, a guy named Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, who's been there. He's been in the storm. He's faced it. He's failed. He's triumphed. He knows what it is to be persecuted for faith. We have our reader, you and me, the church, here in the world that we know we're not really a part of, but yet we're here to try and bring some kind of change. We have the reason for our storm. Because God has pulled us aside from the world for a special purpose, and the enemy can't stand it. And finally, we have a reminder. Look at what he says at the very end of verse 2. May grace and peace be multiplied to you. May grace and peace be multiplied to you. You know, I read something very interesting this week. That when it comes to the island of Great Britain, the warmest place on that island is on the coast. And it surprised a lot of people because for a long time it was believed the warmest part of the island would be the middle, farthest from the ocean, farthest from the breeze, the most calm, the most peaceful. That would be the best place to be. But it turns out the warmest spot is right next to the waves. And I thought that was an incredible illustration of the church, because oftentimes we can have more peace in the middle of a storm than on the calmest of day. And it seems wrong, doesn't it? I mean, that seems backwards. That seems like a paradox or an oxymoron, that you would have more peace in a storm than on a calm day. It would be easier, it seems, to just go with the flow, to just let the world do what it's going to do and not take a stand and not try to live differently and to just do what's easiest, to do what's more relaxing. But sometimes the most dangerous things in life are the easiest things in life. I read something else this week. The river that supplies the water to Niagara Falls, the Niagara River, starts in Lake Erie, and it comes down 36 miles through New York to the falls, and 750,000 gallons a second go over those falls. But here's what was very curious. The calmest part of that river is right before the fall. It's not at the beginning. It's not in the middle. It's right where the water sort of pools in that area before it goes over that precipice. The calmest part of the river comes right before the most dangerous. And sometimes a deceiving calm is more dangerous than a turbulent storm. Many of you know people or have family. We have family in Florida right now who are waiting out this storm. And I've seen their posts on Facebook, and it goes something like, we'd rather the storm come, because the hardest part of these things is waiting. It's this false sense of calm days before you know what's coming. And so they'd rather be dealing with the storm, because then it's exposed and they can see what's going on and they can deal with it then. But this kind of false sense of calm, they say it's torture, it's terrible. And Peter says the same thing about our faith. It may seem easier to go with the flow. It may seem easier to avoid the storm. But remember, Peter isn't writing to believers avoiding a storm. He's writing to believers who are facing one. They're in the middle of one. He says, may grace and peace be multiplied to you. In other words, to be filled up to the max with grace and peace. You remember what David said in Psalm 23. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. He didn't say, even though I avoided the difficulty. He didn't say, even though I avoided the storm, and even though life was nice and peachy and I went with the flow. He says, even though I walked through that deadly valley, you were with me. Even though I faced the challenge, even though I faced the difficulty, I faced the wind, and you were with me. Probably one of the most common misconceptions believers can have, and specifically with new believers, is that when they come to faith, their problems are going to go away. And I've heard people even try and sort of sell the Christian faith that way. They'll say, well, just come to Jesus and all those things go away. And it couldn't be farther from the truth. Remember, Peter isn't writing to believers who have it easy. He's writing to believers who have it very difficult. And when people come into the faith and they have that in their mind and it doesn't happen, it can be very discouraging. Peter will go on to say at the end of this letter in chapter 4, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you, as though something strange were happening. Having your faith rest in Christ doesn't mean your problems go away. It means you get a partner. You get an ally who will give you the peace to deal with those problems, the strength to face those storms head on. Because we have an unshakable faith, and it is built on the rock of truth of an immovable God.